take me about 30 seconds to just do some housekeeping. And you will occasionally see me slip this over and maybe look at the tapes.
Okay.
Don't think I'm not paying attention.
All right, sir.
We just want to make sure that we're recording. The name of the narrator for this is Senator Trent Lott. The name of the interviewers are Paul McCarthy and Charles Padullo. Place of the interview is Bro Lott Leadership Group in Washington, D.C. This is an exit interview slash oral history of Senator Ted Stevens, side A, tape one. Senator Lott, you go back pretty far with Senator Stevens. Could you start with your relationship, how you developed a relationship with him, and how far back as a member of Congress you got to know him?
I think it probably would go back 30 years, at least. I was elected to Congress in 72, but I'd been a staff member 4 years before that for a Democrat congressman, chairman of the Rules Committee, Bill Calmer, and then was sworn into the House and 1973. And, Ted had already been in Washington, in a previous administration over at the Interior Department. I didn't get to know him then. And even as a freshman congressman, I was just trying to figure out what I was going to do in the House. But 8 years later, I was elected as the Republican whip in 1980. And, right after Reagan had elected president. And, of course, Ted was the whip in the Senate. And so that then was the beginning of a relationship. I think he initiated it. Typically of Ted, he probably called. I don't remember that there was a particular call, but said, "Hey, a whip, this is a Senate whip. We ought to look for some opportunities to communicate. So I'll know what you're doing in the House. You'll know what we're doing in the Senate, and we can help each other." And then there were some security issues. We wound up sort of forming a group of whips. House and Senate Republican Democrat met and talked about security in the Capitol, what did we do to protect the perimeter of the Capitol building itself. I was always even an advocate of putting up soundproof, bulletproof, plastic-sized around the House chamber so that our constituents could be briefed on what was being said, what was happening on the floor. And so people couldn't spit on our head or throw a bomb out of the gallery. I never could, sell that. But we did do some things in the 80s to better secure the Capitol building, and people don't go back and look at that. But the bollards, we fixed it where basically you couldn't get a just drive a car or a truck right into the basement of the Capitol way back in, we laid the groundwork in the 80s. And Ted was always very considerate, and I even actually took a couple of trips with him. Overseas, I think we went to the Paris Air Show. He led a delegation, invited me to go. I was the only House member that went. So I just developed a real affinity for him, liked him very much, and my wife and Catherine got to be friends. And then, of course, a few years later, in 1989, I moved over to the Senate and knew that if you wanted to be successful, you ought to seek the advice of some of the more senior members. And I sought the advice of my predecessor, John Stennis, who had served in the Senate for 40 years. He had some good advice, by the way. His advice to me was two things. Number one, buy a house in the District of Columbia. Don't rent. Because at 40 years, he basically rented. And then also he said, when you have an opportunity, take trips and meet with the world's leaders. Even though he had been president pro tem of the Senate and chairman of appropriations and chairman of armed services, he had never left the continental United States. And he felt like it was a huge mistake and that it was a broadening and a learning experience that would help you be a better senator in particular. But immediately after I got to the Senate, I started to collaborating with Ted Stevens and watching him. And, I like to pick at him. And he's a good one to do that. He'll just pick right back, And then not too long after I got to the Senate in 1994, I ran for whip in the Senate against the incumbent, Al Simpson. And Ted was supportive, which was not an easy thing for him. But he knew my whip instincts and my background, and he just felt like that I would bring an ingredient to the leadership as a professional whip, if you will, that would be helpful. And, you know, he counseled me and handled it very carefully. Same thing then when I ran for leader to succeed Bob Dole a year and a half later. He was supportive. But over the years, I had come to respect Ted as just, excellent legislator. Whenever we had a tough bill coming to the floor, I wanted Ted in the chair presiding because he knew the rules, and the Democrats respected his knowledge of the rules. He moved the legislation along, and he wouldn't put up with any shenanigans. So every time it was going to be tense or close, I would send word for Ted to take the chair and preside. But also, I learned to respect his very aggressive advocacy of Alaska and support for programs that were important to Alaska. And I just considered him one of the two or three best legislators, certainly the best appropriator I ever saw, and developed just a real friendship. And he's a super guy. He'd done an awful lot for his state and, frankly, for his country. Here's a guy that flew over the Himalayas, during World War II, and was there at the beginning of Alaska, and served in one administration, and it really just helped bring Alaska into the United States in a way that now exists. And I have nothing but my love and appreciation for Ted Stevens.
You were, when he was appropriations chair, as you said, you were majority leader.
Right.
From a national perspective, pursuit of funding and policy matters. I mean, everybody talks about Alaska, and we talk about all the money for infrastructure and to help a young state. But you were looking at things from a national perspective.
Yeah.
Obviously, an effective lawmaker and an effective policymaker. But how did some of this stuff impact nationally more than just the state?
Well, Ted also was looking at things nationally, particularly when it came to the defense of our country and foreign policy. He would put that above any other consideration. I'll give you a good example. Alaska is not heavily laden with military installations, even though he was always very much involved in the defense appropriations. And I think when he was chairman of the full committee, he continued on as chairman of the subcommittee of defense because he did feel that it was very important that, we have a strong and effective military. And he was always trying to find ways to help our war fighter. So, I mean, there's no question he was a national patriot. As a senator, you do represent a state, but you're much more a part of the national situation. In fact, most senators will tell you, if it's good for the country, it's good for my state. They don't always begin from the standpoint, if it's good for my state, it must be good for America. No, I think it's a little bit of reverse. But, yes, he was aggressive in helping his state, and so was I. I represented one of the poorest states in the nation that had been abused I think neglected for many, many years and had not gotten its fair share of a lot of things, partially because we didn't ask for it. That's one of the things I did to try to help my state get up off its knees. I said, look, if you don't ask, you're not going to get it. Now, we got to get a plan of how we're going to move our state forward, and we got to go up there and fight for our fair share. That's what Ted did. These earmarks that now is considered taboo. Why is it that some bureaucrat at HUD knows more about the need for a water and a sewer system in Chula, Mississippi, or Ketchikan, Alaska? Senators have a knowledge. It's not just about awarding supporters. It's about helping people. And Chula, Mississippi, I probably never got 20% of the vote in Chula, Mississippi. But the stark poverty and the inability to get the federal programs to help it was an embarrassment. To have people in the year 2000 having to carry water to their house to drink and wash their clothes is outrageous. And it's the same thing with Ted. Ted was supportive of the native Alaskans up there. He was trying to get infrastructure. I mean, in a place like Alaska, if you've ever been to Alaska, a lot of places you can't get there from here. You gotta fly to Seattle and into Anchorage, and you gotta take a commuter plane somewhere, and then you gotta get on a float plane, and then you gotta get on a boat. And the roads, just basic roads. So I defend, aggressively the fact that Ted was aggressive for his state. Now, having said all that, when I was majority leader, there were a couple of times when Ted and I locked horns pretty hard because, I was determined that on my watch we will get a grip on spending overall. And my argument was always, look, let's agree on a responsible aggregate number. Here's the number. We're going to control it. We're going to even reduce it, perhaps. But let's get that. And then we'll fight over who gets it underneath that aggregate. Appropriators generally don't like caps or limits or sequestrations across the board. But majority leaders, particularly Republican majority leaders, that are looking at trying to find a way to get the job done, but also begin to move toward a balanced budget and even a surplus, had a little different point of view. So I remember one time we were talking on the phone. I was pressing him basically very hard to control the appropriation spending. He didn't want to do it, and it got so heated that I stood up, and we were basically going at it over the telephone. But we never lost respect for each other. He knew I had a job to do. I knew what he was doing, and we fought it out. But here's the point. And 4 of my 6.5 years as majority leader, with Ted Stevens as Appropriations Committee Chairman, we had a balanced budget and surpluses. We had not had them since 1969, and we have not had them since. So you can be critical of me, and you can be critical of Ted as Chairman of the Appropriations Committee, but on our watch, we took care of our states, but we also took care of the fiscal policy of the country.
Senator, that's great information, because no one and I hadn't thought of that, and we hadn't seen it in our research. So thank you. When he's appropriations and chair and your leader, you did say you guys clashed.
Sure, we clashed.
Omnibus budget bills, there's tons of things.
I hated them.
Give me some of the issues. I know ANWR would have been a debate.
What were some
of the issues that you debated over that created the most kind of hard?
Oh, well, I would.
And as you're responding, please, you had mentioned before we started talking, you had a nickname for the senator.
Well, when Ted would get ready to handle a bill on the floor, he knew how to move a bill. And he would wear one of his Hulk ties or the Tasmanian devil tie, because he would just come to the floor and it would just be a tear through the legislative process. And quite often, when he would get ready to try to finish up a bill, the so-called manager's package, John McCain would show up and object. And then I'd have to mediate, the little tussle between Ted and John. Because of a friendship with Ted, I could talk to Ted. But philosophically, on a lot of those points, I was actually with McCain. Because quite often there were shenanigans that did things that wound up in manager's packages that shouldn't have been there. But Ted knew how to move legislation, and quite often he had the Democrats working with him. That's another thing. Ted knew how to work across the aisle. I mean, it's not just his personal affinity going back to World War II factors with Inouye. Democrats generally respected him. Bob Byrd, obviously. Other senior members on the Appropriations Committee. Of course, we always said that there were three kinds of members of Congress. There were Republicans, there were Democrats, and there were appropriators. And they were neither. They were appropriators first, and party members and national leaders after that. When he would come to the floor, it was really something to behold. And as majority leader, I was always pleased to have somebody that knew the rules and knew the legislative process and had the experience to move the bill. Because the biggest problem for the majority leader is just getting something done. I mean, it's easy to block things in the Senate, but it is the devil to move things in an affirmative way. Now, having said that, I was always a supporter of ANWR. I believe you should drill wherever oil and gas is. If it's in my front yard, put down the well, baby. And I think the American people, really basically agree with that. We've never really come to terms with energy policy. We can get more oil and gas, and we can do it environmentally safely. We can get more hydropower. We can do nuclear power. We can do wind and solar, but I really think that's hokey. We're going to spend billions and get very little, but I'm willing to try it, conservation, all of that. But here's another rule that I had, and I think Ted Stevens kind of had this rule too. If you had two senators from a state that said, this is something the people of our state want and we support, I gave them the overwhelming benefit of the doubt. Whether it was two Republicans or two Democrats or one of each, I respected the knowledge of the senators of the people they represented. I would have supported Anwar on that basis, if no other. But also, I wanted the oil and gas out of Anwar. And I never could understand why senators from New Hampshire or Maine would hyperventilate over some teeny part of Alaska, which they would never see, had no knowledge of, worrying about caribou, while the caribou loved the pipelines. It just, so I guess that's one reason why Ted, I guess we had a good relationship, because he knew that philosophically, when it comes to that sort of issue, we were very much in tune, and I always voted with him, and I always tried to design it where he would have the best opportunity to win. Now, sometime he pushed for things like Anwar that balled up bills, but I didn't mind that. Now, at some point, I would say, I remember one of the saddest things I ever saw was when we had that close vote on Anwar one night, and Ted, you know, basically said, why am I here? And, you know, he was really disappointed. And there was some thinking on his part and others, let's just kill this bill. And the next day, that was the discussion. And my argument was, I'm not even sure I was majority leader then, but my argument at the time was, look, guys, he had a shot. He took his best shot. We came up a little short. Got to move on. And Ted accepted that. It was very hard for him.
What are some of the other issues where you as majority leader had to tell him to back off? Any specifics? I'm sure there's a number, but just for the record, what are some of the things that he fought?
Well, not very much. First of all, you tried to limit it because you didn't like drawing back a nub, because he would be very, very aggressive. But, you know, because of our relationship, he got to where he would, he would actually come to me with ideas. I remember we had a project one time that was moving forward but not doing great, and he showed up in my office with an idea of a solution. I thought it was excellent. I couldn't get the parties involved to agree to it, but Ted was looking for a way to get the right thing done for the Air Force, but the contractors wouldn't buy that. I remember sitting in his office listening to some of the things. In fact, one of the things I got to where I did as a majority leader, I would go early in the year to Ted's office and sit down with him and say, Ted, how do you see this year? What kind of money you're talking about? How you're going to assign the amounts to each committee? What are you thinking about in terms of timing? One of the things that I did with Ted that majority leaders have since not learned to do, about the only thing you have to do every year is pass appropriations bills. You got to do it, or the departments of government shuts down. Now, you can do it orderly, or you can do it messy. So what I did, I think the first year I came in as majority leader in 06, there may have been one or two more times since then where every appropriations was passed freestanding, every appropriations bill. But what my general thinking was is, okay, appropriators, have your hearings, do your subcommittee work in March and April, get them out of full committees in May, and then the floor is yours in June and July. Now, that's a sacrifice for the majority leader, because basically you're setting aside all these policy issues that, you know, we like to play with. But my attitude was, it takes time, you have to do it in an orderly way, and it takes about 2 months to get them through the Senate so that you can have August and September for the staff work to be done and for the conferences to meet, so you can get them done by the October the 1st. And I think the fact that I would talk to Ted, and kind of look at the year, I think he appreciated that. And I think it was helpful to us in getting our job done. But the biggest conflicts we had was, trying to keep a limit on the discretionary spending. He would always, have a real fiery speech in which he would say, look, the percentage of the government that goes to discretionary spending, which is the annual appropriations bills, is continuing to decline, and it's these entitlements that's eating up all our money. He was right. Absolutely. The problem in the government is not how much we spend on transportation or interior or defense. It's these uncontrollable, supposedly, which I don't think are uncontrollable, entitlements Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, you know, student aid, Social Security, let me just continue to just explode. So when I would try to get a limit on discretionary aggregate spending or by category, he wouldn't like that. And we gave it our best shot, and, quite often he'd outmaneuver me, but sometime I'd managed to hold in the reins. And, of course, in that period, I actually had somewhat of an ally in President Bill Clinton.
It's interesting, earmarks and set aside.
See, I was more of a budgeteer than an appropriator. I was never on appropriations, and, nationally, I didn't come to Washington to be a spender. I came to try to control the size of government, taxes and regulation and all of that. Ted had a little different take on that, and so that was the only place we ever really had disagreements.
Let me ask you about appropriation, earmarks, and the ability to put things in. I think that, there's a lack of understanding publicly what percentage of the budget earmarks and set-asides are. And Ted Stevens has gotten a reputation, fairly or unfairly, as being a pork barrel politician. Can you just talk about that? I think that there's a lack of understanding nationally.
Well, there is a lack of understanding nationally, and it was demagogued to the maximum by Barack Obama and John McCain and the media. Just love to, pound people. Now, so I think it is an absolute legitimate thing for a senator or a congressman to try to get earmarks or line items for needs in their particular states. No question about it, and I'll defend that till the last day I live. And I did it as long as I was in the Senate. We used to have votes on amendments by Republican senators, Jim DeMint or some of them, or Tom Coburn. Oh, we're going to stop these earmarks. No, you're not. You're never going to do that. There's a little thing called the Constitution, number one. Now, the purse strings are controlled by the Congress, not by presidents, and not by some nameless, faceless, hopeless bureaucrat at the Department of Transportation or HUD or Interior. Why should we just send a block of money down to the Mississippi Department of Transportation and say, you decide where it's going to be spent? Well, they have their own prejudices and priorities, which may not be, when you look at the aggregate of the state, the right ones. Now, having said that, when I first came over to the Senate and when I was in the House, I never got many earmarks when I was in the House, maybe a few, but not many, because particularly as a freshman congressman, you know, even though I'd been a staff member and I knew the process better than most because I had been worked for the chairman of the Rules Committee and then I was on the Rules Committee. And I learned the process, and once you learn the process, then you're dangerous. And but still, a freshman or a younger Republican congressman in a minority, you don't get much. But as you work your way up, and once you get in the leadership, then you do have a little more influence with what goes into a highway bill or an appropriations bill, what can be spent. In those days, though, to get an add-on or a light item in an appropriations bill, you pretty much have to have already gotten it authorized. So if you wanted to have a port channel deepening project, you had to have it authorized before you could for the Corps, before you could get it appropriated. And that was a good requirement. And then when I came to the Senate, earmarks generally were, they happened, but there weren't that many, and generally they went to senior appropriators and leadership. Well, once I got in the majority leader's position, I learned how to work those levers pretty well. In one year, I actually worked myself up to the title of Prince of Pork, which was number two. I never could overtake Ted or Bob Byrd, but I worked up to the number two position, and I was very proud of that. But as the years went by, more and more congressmen and senators learned how to work the system. And it went from just the more senior members of key committees and our leaders, then it began to work its way down the line in the House, on tax bills. And see, that's another thing. People always blame the appropriators. Let me tell you what, some of the biggest earmarks I've ever seen to benefit individual companies were in tax bills. And they really unnerved me. And so as the years went by, more and more congressmen and senators started milking the system. And then, and it just kind of, and it, you didn't have to have it authorized, and it wouldn't even be in a bill that came out of a committee, or it wouldn't even be in either bill out of House or Senate. And then one day, boom, it pop up in a conference report, and the numbers begin to grow. Now, still, as a percent of what's spent, it's small, but I do think that in this century, Congress, Republicans and Democrats, but Republicans have to say we kind of lost our grip on things. It got more and more grew, and it got, I think, more irresponsible. I remember one night in particular, I was on the Finance Committee, and I was Majority Leader, and we had a conference meeting, and it was down to where you really make the final decisions, and there were probably four or five of us total in the room. And it was like at 10 o'clock at night, and I remember Speaker Hastert was in the room, and I was in the room, and it probably, you know, the Chairman of the Ways and Means, Chairman of Finance, maybe a couple of Democrats, but it got down to a pretty small group, and the decision was made to put a particular provision in this tax bill that really would benefit a particular company, which really bothered me, and it was billions. And I went back to my office, and I told my Chief of Staff, Dave Hoppe, Dave, we've got to stop this. The opportunity for trouble here, or, you know, quid pro quo is extremely dangerous. Where you put drop something in a conference at 10 o'clock at night that was in neither bill that could benefit a sector or a company to the tune of billions. Now, Ted Stevens was not in the room on that. So I do think that there needs to be some reining in of that sort of thing. And I actually supported some changes. I supported a procedure which would have blocked, when I was chairman of the Rules Committee in the Senate, to block that type of just dropping something in conference. Made it subject to a point of order when it came back for the conference, where it could be knocked out solely without killing the whole bill. And the rules were such that if you pulled a piece out, the whole thing went down. Now, it would still have to bounce back to the House, but it gave you a process to knock out a particular, you know, abusive type of procedure.
So I'm going to, you said you were a budget guy when you were Majority Leader, and
yeah, sure.
Senator Stevens was an appropriator.
Sure.
If you look back and you look at policy, you know, were there any issues where Republican policy was changed or shaped, or Senator Stevens was involved in helping shape any particular issues?
Oh yeah, Ted was involved in every, leadership decision, because as chairman of the Appropriations Committee, quite often we'd have a leadership meeting, we'd bring in Ted. He was very senior, too, even though he was not President Pro Tem at the time, Strom Thurmond was. He was in on the discussions, and I remember one time there was an issue coming up that the Democrats were going to invoke a point of order. They were going to try to block us on a rule procedure. And the general attitude is, when it's a pure parliamentary issue, you know, your members are supposed to stick with you, even if they're, you know, more liberal or more moderate than the rest of the party. When that was an affront to the leadership. But I can't remember what the issue was, but it was pretty dicey. And I remember, for some odd reason, we couldn't have a good place to have a meeting. We wound up having the meeting up in what was then the Senate Library, okay, very cramped quarters. And I remember Link Chafee got up and basically said, you know, I don't agree with you on this issue, and I'm thinking about, you know, I'm going to vote with the Democrats on this point of order. And Ted got up as one of the old bulls, probably the most knowledgeable of the old bulls, and said, no, let me explain this to you. This is what we're talking about, and when you're challenged by the minority on a point like this, you support the leader. That's the end of the discussion. And Link Chafee kind of sheepishly sat back down. We had the vote, and we won. So Ted, he knew the rules. He knew how to use the rules, but he would defend the rules, and he would also defend the leader. That's one thing I always, you know, sometimes people would say, where's Ted going to be? I said, Ted's going to be with the leadership. They said, why? I said, because he served in World War II. And they said, what do you mean? I said, that generation understood that there was a chain of command. And somebody's in a position that has to make a decision, and somebody has to carry it out. And Ted understood that. That generation understood it. The current generations do not. And that's one of the things I admire the most about Ted Stevens and our fathers and grandfathers' generation. But he, even in the end, you know, when the leadership would make a call, Ted would be the first to get in line, even though he may have fought it like a tiger.
I'm going to move back to Anwar for a second. You know, Senator Stevens is probably the most influential person in the history of the state of Alaska, no matter what you
think. Sure, absolutely.
If there's any doubt.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think he would look back and say is a frustration or a disappointment would be the lack of his ability to pass Anwar during his time. Why did it not pass? What were the stumbling blocks?
I think it's a great tragedy for Alaska, but more importantly for the American people. We need what could come out of that very, very small area and can be done in a very environmentally safe way. It just became the cause celeb for the greenies in the country, the Sierra Club. So you had senators from states that were basically against oil and gas and energy, you know, New York. But even you had senators from states like New Hampshire, good guys that should have known better. But it was a green issue in New Hampshire. And, you know, they have some hills and ski slopes. And so even a conservative Republican from New Hampshire would jump ship. And, you know, maybe there were other factors involved there.
Could he have done anything differently? Could Senator Stevens have done anything differently?
Well, you know, Stevens and Frank Murkowski, the other senator, were both, you know, I called, my nickname for Murkowski was a moose, because he was like, you know, like a big old moose, you know, being from Alaska. And they both were pretty aggressive. Now, I used to ask them, why are you guys so grumpy? And I finally figured out what it was. They were flying back and forth to Alaska on weekends. I mean, they did it all the time. Basically, they were sleepy. That's why they were grumpy. But they were, you know, they were very aggressive and would get, you know, energized on lots of issues. And of course, Frank became chairman of the Energy Committee. And I think there was some feeling, okay, now we got it. We got Frank at Energy. We got Ted at Appropriations. I actually thought that Lisa, Frank's daughter, would soften the edges a little bit and would maybe help get Anwar. And she's still trying. In fact, just yesterday, there was a vote on Energy Committee where she's now ranking 13-10. And a subsequent vote, I think, was actually 12-11. That might have involved the Gulf. But, you know, there's just a huge element in America in the news media that just believes that we don't need oil and gas and we can live on less. And that they, you know, they don't like anything but solar power. And it's amazing to me, you know, how many people have bought that. I'm not one of those. My attitude has always been, this is America. We can always produce more. We don't have to do it with less. But so I'm a very aggressive, produce more of everything advocate. But I finally concluded, look, why are we fighting over this? Why are the Republicans saying produce more of everything? And Democrats saying, oh, no, let's use alternatives and let's conserve. And let's make people drive, you know, people, purple people eater little small automobiles. By the way, I drive a Mini Cooper now. So, but my attitude is, well, wait a minute. Why don't we just do it all? Let's explore more. Let's do hydro. Let's do nuclear. Let's do wind and solar and biodiesel. Let's see whatever we can do with alternatives. And let's conserve, too. Let's give people incentives to, but don't punish them. Give them incentives to put in different appliances and insulate their homes and do all that stuff. And so I really thought that maybe when we kind of changed our positioning, maybe the Sierra Club and others would change theirs. They didn't. So Anwar now has become such a symbol. I think maybe what we ought to do is change the name and pick a little different area and say, oh, this is not Anwar, and do exactly what we were going to do at Anwar. I do think that sometime, you know, that maybe the aggressiveness didn't help, but I know how passionate they felt about it, and I agreed with them. It was very disappointing that the Senate could not get that job done, to me.
Well, you talk about the aggressiveness and lack of sleep, and Senator Stevens's temper. We've talked to many folks during this project about
it. Half of that temper is for effect. He's an old courtroom prosecutor. You know, it's kind of like a Southerner using, look, I'm just a country boy argument. Nobody really believes it. But we do it anyway for effect. Usually when we start giving that old, look, I need some help. I just don't know how this system works. And would you give me a hand here? You know, I'm just a country boy. We're fixing to pick your pocket. So that's our technique. Ted's technique was, he'd blow up and everybody draw back, and then they'd concede points to him. It was for effect. But he also, Ted's a passionate guy, and that's one reason why I love him. Anybody that's milquetoast and, you know, doesn't care about their issues or their state should be in the United States Senate.
The one thing, you know, because we'll go to legacy and then a couple more things, the trial and the Justice Department. Just walk through your thoughts on the process.
Well, maybe I should be careful, because I do think that the Justice Department and the FBI and the Public Integrity Section of the Justice Department have all become rogue organizations that really didn't think they were answerable to anybody. And what I saw happen to Ted Stevens is one of the most egregious abuses of the legal system in America I've ever seen. And I don't even call it a justice system anymore. It's only a legal system. But the kind of things they did, like when the FBI supposedly raided his house, he offered them the key. They didn't have to raid it. They could just unlock the door and walk in. But no. They wanted it to be a raid. And, by the way, it was just quite a coincidence that the media was there to get the picture. Mueller should be ashamed of the FBI's conduct in that investigation. I do think the Justice Department was used for partisan political reasons in Alaska, that I still don't understand why all that went on. And by the way, a lot of it went on in the Bush administration. And I think one of my greatest disappointments in President Bush was, after 8 years, he went out, he had no control over his own administration. He didn't know what was going on at Homeland Security. He didn't know what was going on in the Justice Department. The number of personnel went up. They were all just running amok. And I'm embarrassed and ashamed of that. But the trial itself, I have never seen such prosecutorial abuse in my life. I mean, I am a lawyer. Now, I haven't practiced law in a long time, but I studied law and I wrote the laws. Isn't that interesting? You're not a lawyer, even though you're involved in 35 years, or actually 39 in my case, in writing the laws, but they say, oh, you don't know the law. Well, yeah. And I am a member of bars in two states. One of the basic things you learn is you cannot withhold evidence that is exculpatory for a defendant. There was a pattern of that happening in the Public Integrity Section. The conduct of that woman in that trial, the conduct of the people involved, and the unseemly relationships developed was a shame and a blot on the legal history of this country. And I am so proud of Eric Holder and eventually the judge, who kept threatening to throw this thing out because of prosecutorial excesses and abuses, that Eric Holder came in. Now, Bush administration, a Bush attorney general, probably couldn't have done it. But Eric Holder had the guts to look at this and say, wait a minute, this is wrong. And now there are not one but two investigations going on what happened there. An independent investigator appointed by the judge and one of the Public Integrity Section of the Justice Department appointed by Eric Holder. It's just outrageous. And it actually brings me to tears to think that a guy like Ted Stevens, who served his country in World War II, spent all of his life trying to help his state and create and make and build a state like Alaska, when he reaches 84, 85 years of age, he's defeated unfairly because of the timing of everything, abused by the legal system in America, disgraced, and then everybody says, oh, wait a minute, this is not fair, and, so, okay. So he's, you know, you could say he got his reputation back. But how does he ever, you know, recover from this at that age? And, you know, he lost the thing he loved the most, the ability to help Alaska. It's sad. But at least they had the ability to throw that verdict out and give him a chance to go on with his life. But it's one of the dark blots on the history of the legal system in America.
You said partisan politics. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Oh, I think there's no question that the Democrats politically fed this investigation and intended to get Ted, yeah.
So the FBI and the Justice Department and all
Justice Department in particular were being used by Democratic politicians. And then I don't know how the FBI fitted in that, except I think they kind of just do what the public integrity section of the Justice Department tells them. I don't know. But that alleged raid on his house,
Mueller,
outrageous.
About the Justice Department, it was surprising that the indictment came down while the election was going on. Any thoughts on that?
Sure, it was politically motivated. No question about it.
Isn't there an unwritten rule inside justice that you wait till elections are over or you don't indict?
I don't know. Look, I don't know that much about the Justice Department. I wasn't ever on the Judiciary Committee in the Senate. I was on the Judiciary Committee in the House for, I guess, 4 years. But I learned a long time ago, basically, just stay away from the Justice Department, stay away from lawyers, stay away from judges, because there's only one thing can happen if you deal with lawyers in the Justice Department, and it's all bad.
I'm
ashamed to feel that way, but I do. I think we've got a system now where judges are out of control. I've gone back and forth in my own mind, and I've changed my position twice, but I really think that one of the places our forefathers made a mistake was when they gave federal judges lifetime appointments. I don't think human nature can withstand being put in an exalted position where you're answerable to nobody.
The hardest thing about this project is to have to talk about Senator Stevens' legacy and the trials.
Sure.
Part of it.
Yeah.
Talk about his legacy. What he meant to the state, he meant to the country. And if, you know, I'd like you to talk about that and then answer a separate question. And does what happened with the Justice Department taint what he had achieved?
Oh, surely it's a taint. And, you know, in his eulogies that are written in the media, at least, they will always have, a paragraph about all of that. And that's tragic because here's a man with a life of 84 years of accomplishments and production and everything he did throughout his life for his family and for his state, for his country, and then to have this happen at the end, it was very, very sad. Now, I think it'll also have that asterisk. Oh, and by the way, the trial was, the verdict was overturned and thrown out. And I don't think we've seen the last of Ted. Ted may be 85, but the Taz ain't done. He'll be around.
I'm going to ask you. I think the last words you had said were the Taz ain't done.
Well, look, he's trying to figure out what he does with his life now and how he can be productive. I don't know how he manages to still look and be as energetic as he is. I mean, it just astounds him. You know, when I actually went by to see him last week, it took me back once again when he said, you know, I'm 85. And I'm thinking, golly, Bob. I mean, he's wiry and, you know, he's still in good shape. And I don't know, maybe it's eating all that salmon up there in Alaska. Something is, maybe it's just the genes, but time will cure some of the pain and will blur some of the negatives of this. And in Alaska, I think Alaskans probably feel really bad about what happened to him and what they did, with the election. But having been on the mountaintop myself and been down in the valley of the shadow of death, I've learned that if you take your lumps and just keep on paddling, that you can come back up on the other side of the mountain. And who knows what good things might happen for Ted. I think he'll still be involved in trying to get things done for Alaska. Who knows, you know, what he'll be able to do in terms of another institute. And I think he wants to, you know, be a player. Maybe he'll write a book. I don't know. But he deserves to be remembered as one of the, you know, the great patriots and one of the most effective legislators in the Senate in the last 50 years. If I were going to write a book along the lines of profiles of courage and, you know, effective legislative ability, it'd probably shock people who I would have in that book. It would be people like, you know, Ted Kennedy and Dianne Feinstein and John McCain and Ted Stevens.
Do you have any anecdotes you'd like to share that sort of explain your relationship with Senator Stevens? I mean, you've told a couple, but we always like to ask folks. Sometimes people come up with some interesting stories. Senator Inouye was very funny yesterday. He said, those are between Ted and I.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I think one reason why Ted and I always got along, first of all, I think he liked the fact that I was a little bit of a warrior for my state and the way I felt about my country. So philosophically, we were pretty close. But also, you know, there were times when people were kind of afraid of Ted or would say, I ain't going in the lion's lair. He'll eat me alive. And I'd just wander in there and start picking at him, you know. And I think that he liked that. So I always will remember my relationships with, other than the one time when I really got mad at him about controlling spending, I always had a smile on my face when I was dealing with Ted. And I think that he knew I knew him. He couldn't fool me with that. But I don't, you know, he never got threatening to me because he didn't need to. We were copacetic, you know. We were very similar in many respects. I mean, obviously, I was not, you know, the same age. I was of a different generation. And now there's another generation after me. But I think we always felt a kindred relationship in our styles and in our philosophies and in the positions we held.
It must have been a difficult... Ted Stevens is not a traditional Republican. As you said, he worked across party lines very
sure.
effectively, built strong relationships.
Sure.
As a majority leader, was that something difficult to manage?
Sure. I do think, now this is about talking about me, and we're supposed to be talking about Ted, but I think Ted would say this too, that the toughest political leadership job in Washington is majority leader, more than Speaker of the House, because the Speaker has a Rules Committee. He or she can be a dictator. I mean, they've got the power. They control the agenda, the time it's debated, the amendments, the votes. President, when the president makes a decision, if he's effective, things happen. He sends word down to, you know, the Department of Education, do this or that, and things are supposed to happen. Now, I think in recent years, Bush sort of lost the ability to do that. They didn't feel like he could make them do anything he didn't want to. but, you know, he probably should have fired a lot more of them. Now, what was the basic question?
Was it difficult to manage?
Oh, no, no. Yeah. Being in Congress 35 years and serving in, I guess, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different leadership positions, both in the majority and minority, I learned some lessons. And when I first came to Washington and it was into Congress, I was, I was 32 years old. And I was very principled and, very philosophically committed. And my attitude was, I'm going to have it my way or no way. And what I got was no way. And over the years, I learned that, look, legislative process is a very difficult, ugly, lengthy process, and it doesn't work unless you got people that are willing to give a little, get a little, and try to find a way to find the sweet spot to get something done. Now, I was always a very philosophically conservative Republican, and my voting record would show that. But I think my demeanor was a little bit more moderate. Because usually I wasn't mad about it, you know. I always tried to find a way to inject humor in what was going on. But I also had learned that you have to work with everybody to make something happen. And so actually, I learned to use the abilities of people like Ted Stevens, who could get me intelligence, first of all. I mean, Ted, remember, he was a president pro tem, he was chairman of appropriations, but before that he was a whip. He knew how to count votes. And I could go to Ted and say, what do you think? What do you hear on the Democratic side? Can you help me get this vote or that vote? I can remember being in the well of the Senate when a vote was going on, it'd be a close vote. And I would see that there was a Democrat that maybe hadn't voted that Ted knew or was close to, and I could go to him and say, can you give us a hand here? And I can remember more than one occasion where we wound up winning by a vote or two thanks to the relationship that Ted had with a Danny Inouye or a Bob Byrd. So it made it difficult sometime, but more often than not, it was an ability and a talent that helped the Senate move forward. There were two occasions, one when I was in the majority and one when I was actually in the minority, where I saw the Senate actually rise above partisan politics and get things done for the country. One of them was in 1996 through 98, when we had the majority in the House and the Senate, and Bill Clinton had the White House. And what did we get done? We passed all the appropriations bills. We moved to a balanced budget or surplus. We had welfare reform, safe drinking water, portability of insurance. How did all that happen? You know, was Clinton just rolling over? No. We were working with Clinton. And, we were finding ways to produce a result that benefited the American people. And it wasn't easy for Clinton, and it wasn't easy for me. I had, I had my little group. I had a group I called the Council of Trent. I don't know how familiar you are with history, but there used to be a Council of Trent. And I had this group of senators, not in the leadership, that I would bring in, and I would tell them kind of what I was thinking about doing. Ted quite often came into those meetings, because it was kind of a lot of people said, well, who's on the Council of Trent? And I said, well, I can't tell you. They said, why not? I said, because it varies from time to time. It depends on the issue. I remember one time I was making a deal with Clinton. And Judd Gregg said, you're getting mighty far out on a limb. I said, I don't care. Pat Monahan's willing to do it. The president says he's willing to do it. We're going to do it. So I jump out there on that limb. Within 2 days, Clinton called and said, you know what? I really can't do that. Sawed the limb off right behind me. Did I fully answer your question?
You
there?
Did. Yeah? You talk about the need to work across the aisle and the value.
Oh, yeah. Let's see now. There was another time I was going to cite. Oh, yeah. After 9/11, we were in the minority. There was a run there between 9/11 and the end of that calendar year 2001, in which we produced massive pieces of legislation on a unbelievable fast track to do the right thing for our country. And the approval rating of the Senate went up to like the 80s. Never been that level before or since. Why? Because the American people, in a crisis, saw us putting aside partisan labels and getting things done. The Patriot Act, which, of course, the Democrats, hated from then on, but it was a bipartisan effort. We did a lot of things. Some of them, by the way, Republicans didn't like too much either. But Ted was always on board with that. Ted was always one that, says, look, we got to get things done for our country. And he was somebody I could always count on to help me get votes and to help me, develop the tactics to produce a result.
I know that we're running low on time, but there's two issues, and you may have been in the House for them that sort of define Senator Stevens, two of the most tragic events in his life before the trial. One was losing his wife.
Oh, surely.
And the second was, one was personal, yeah, certainly more difficult than, and the other one was professional.
Yeah.
The majority leader vote was
7-1. Yeah.
Could you talk about your perceptions of either of those?
Well, I may not be the best one to ask about that because I was not then in the Senate. I was watching it from across the Capitol. The presumption was that, in some corners, was that Ted should have been the odds-on favorite. Now, the problem was, that was a new phenomenon for Republicans to be electing the majority leader. I believe it was the majority leader, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so you had five people jump in there, as I recall. Lugar was in there, Domenici was in there, McClure was in there, Dole and Stevens. And that's a legendary group when you think about it. Probably if you looked at that, Ted would have probably been considered one of the more moderate people in that race. And, of course, they started dropping off. And then was Ted in the final two with Dole? Yeah. I'm sure he was disappointed, obviously, in how that went. And, he should have been elected, probably. Yeah, he should have won that. But the Republican Senate conference at that time was very different than it was when I came along and got elected majority leader. First of all, we had an invasion of conservative House members. We basically moved in and took over the Senate. At that time, the Senate Republicans were they had a pretty substantial sort of liberal Republican and moderate Republicans. And then you had a smaller group of conservatives, actually, people like McClure and Helms and Thurman. And they weren't very well organized. And I think other factors started playing in there. Well, if Dole wins, he's not chairman of finance, who will be chairman of finance? And there was some wheeling and dealing going on there. So just from what I saw, surely he was disappointed. And in my opinion, he should have won that race.
And any perceptions? You would have been in the House. I don't know how close you were with the senator when his wife passed away.
No, I was. I did not really know him then. I think that was back in the, when would that have been? In the 60s? Was it the 70s?
Yeah,
I was, this was before I really started having any contact with him. And, of course, I remember hearing about it, and I've heard him talk about it. But he didn't talk about it very much. I guess that's painful. But he always felt like there was another guy in Alaska that sort of caused that, And there was a little bit of a bitterness there. Ted has and that's why I think he's going to be okay now. Ted had the ability to take a serious blow and move on. That was obviously a personal, heart-rending, terrible experience that did, bug him for years. But his life went on. He had wonderful kids by that marriage, and he found Catherine, and Catherine reinvigorated him, was a perfect fit for the Taz and her own way. And then, just like the leader's race, he made his race, he made the best of it. He never again tried to get back in the leadership. I mean, you could say theoretically, even when I ran for leader, why didn't Ted come back and try to do that again? But he took his best shot. It didn't work out. He settled in as chairman of the Appropriations Committee and eventually President Pro Tem and went forward. That's a great way to be.
One of the great themes that we've noticed is his interest in appropriating funds to support Native people.
Yeah, he was very passionate about all of the people in Alaska, but it's not a big voting block. But it was obvious that he felt like the Native Alaskans should have a better life, and he didn't just read about them or he went to where they were. He talked a lot about their culture, and a lot of the stuff that you'd see in his office came from Native Alaskans. But he tried to help them with their basic needs, their fundamental needs, and he felt like the government had a responsibility to help them have a better life. And it wasn't just politics; it was something he really personally cared about.
I mean, you talk about clean water in this
country. Sure, sure, yeah, yeah. All right.
Anything?
We really like deeply appreciate it.
Well, I hope it's useful. And.